The information and ideas discussed in this program are intended to be educational and to motivate listeners to take control of their own financial future. Because the subject matter is complex and situations differ widely between individuals, we strongly recommend that you consult qualified professionals before acting on the information discussed in the program.
Hello and welcome to Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason.
And Peter.
And we've got another great show for you today. Today we'll be interviewing Pete Wheeler from Wheeler Frost Associates on stock options and grants. Peter's the author of the book, Stock Options and Grants, An Executive's Guide to Equity Compensation.
In the interest of full disclosure, we should mention that our affiliated company, Advisor Press, publishes Pete Wheeler's book.
Pete will be talking about the different types of stock options, taxation on stock options, and some of the new options planning that we're starting to see now with the expensing of stock options.
So if you work for a company that where you have stock options or grants, you'll want to listen to that because a lot of people make big mistakes. They listen to their fellow workers who may be misinformed, and it can be a very expensive lesson to learn. So if you or someone you know is involved with stock options, then this is a good show to listen to. Pete's book, by the way, is one of the most recent books on the subject. There's just a handful of books that we're aware of that cover what we call employee compensatory stock options. There are another kind of stock options which are listed on the stock exchanges, which are stock options to buy stocks at certain prices as well. But they're done with public stock or stock on the exchanges. We're talking about something that's earned as part of a compensation package, and there are certain tax advantages if they're handled correctly.
That's right. I also would like to add that this show will be interesting to those who may own a small company and are looking for ways to compensate their employees and tie their performance into the company's performance. So that'll be a good segment, I think. To start with, though, Peter, why don't we go to our email and answer questions?
Well, we got an email last week about the differences between 401ks versus Roths, trying to decide which would be a better investment vehicle. To quote it, is I had a question about which is better, 401k or a Roth IRA. 401k is tax deferred while the Roth IRA is tax exempt but carries no tax deduction. It seems to me that if I plan on being in a higher tax bracket when I retire, seems good to have income grow over time, that the Roth IRA is a better investment vehicle. My financial advisor tells me that they're starting to play games with the AMT, the alternative minimum tax, and money drawn from the Roth IRA will bump me up into a higher tax bracket. Is this true? Is the IRS looking to tax my Roth IRA in sneaky ways? And which is the superior investment vehicle?
Well, Peter, I'm not sure who his financial planner is. We'll answer that in a minute. First, I think it's a great topic. I'm glad that this listener brought this to our attention. I think it's good that people are thinking about the different savings vehicles, especially for retirement, and trying to get an understanding of which ones may be better for different people in different situations. So why don't we go ahead and Peter, why don't you take a swing at this?
Sure. The first item that came to my mind when I looked at this question was, does the employer have a matching option in the 401k choice? We'd recommend that if there is an employer matching provision, usually it's something like 50 cents on the dollar up to 4% or 5%. Sometimes it's dollar for dollar. If there is a matching provision, then it makes sense to go with the 401k up to that level that the match is good for, at least. Because that return right off the bat of 50 or 100% is extremely valuable.
Well, right. In that scenario, your employer is giving you money to help you out with your retirement, and you can't beat that.
No, it's guaranteed right off the bat. So we would recommend funding up to the level where matching ends, at least. And beyond that, then perhaps funding the Roth IRA outside of the company plan. And when that's funded, then going back and adding more to the 401k. So let's say a person had $10,000 of discretionary income to save each year. They might put $5,000 or $4,000 into the 401k to get it up to the matching, put the next $4,000 into an IRA, a Roth IRA, and then the last $1,000 or $2,000 in addition in the 401k.
Now, there's one thing we should mention here, and that is that everybody isn't eligible to contribute to a Roth.
So you have to be careful about contribution limits, and if your income is over certain levels, then the IRS doesn't let you contribute to a Roth IRA. For individuals, that limit is $95,000. Up to that point, you can make a full contribution to the IRA. It's to the Roth IRA. It's phased out over the next $10,000. So an individual making more than $105,000 is not allowed to make any contribution to a Roth. Married couples can earn a little more before they're shut out of the Roth, and that's $150,000 before they start being phased out. So the question or the decision between the Roth and the 401k may be answered by the income level. If the Roth isn't available, then the decision is made, essentially. Also, I'd like to say that the IRS is not at this time moving to capture part of the Roth in some sort of tax trap. Roth IRAs are relatively new, and the government, the whole approach that's being taken right now is trying to provide incentives for people to save. So I think we have a lot to be thankful to Senator Roth for, because these are very generous plans. There's a lot of flexibility in Roth IRAs, and probably more than we have time to go into here. Perhaps another day we could do that on the show.
Yeah, I think it's a topic unto itself.
But the specific questions are the things that this other financial planner or advisor raised, the issue of the alternative minimum tax. At this point in time, Roth IRAs are not counted as preference items and therefore are not added back to the calculation for the alternative minimum tax. And they're not taxed at all for purposes of the regular tax either. So there's no way that it's going to raise a person's tax bracket to take the distributions from a Roth.
No. In fact, Roth money goes in is taxed before it goes in. That's the whole design of the Roth program. It's you pay your normal income tax, and then you can take your post-tax money and put it into a Roth if you're eligible. But that brings up another point and something that the listener asked us, and that is about tax brackets and how, you know, is that an important ingredient in making a decision on a Roth or any retirement account for that matter?
Yeah, it's a great point, a very important one to consider. If your tax bracket's going to be higher later, all things being equal, then it's better to have the tax break later when you're taking the money out. So a Roth IRA would be an advantage there where there's no tax on the distributions. On the other hand, if the tax bracket is substantially higher now, it's probably better to get that deduction now while you're in a higher tax bracket.
And these are things that your accountant can help you figure out. We're presenting concepts and answering questions, but when it comes down to crunching numbers, you really need to speak to your accountant about this.
Absolutely. Well, a couple of other related items about Roths is, besides making contributions to a Roth, it's possible in many cases and advantageous to convert a regular IRA to a Roth IRA. There are several factors that have to be looked at to see if it makes sense, such as, will it put you in a substantially higher tax bracket to make a conversion? Obviously, if you make too much, it isn't so obvious, I guess, but there is a cutoff. The government says if you earn over $100,000, whether you're single or a couple, then a Roth conversion is not allowed.
And the person would need to decide whether to do a conversion all in 1 year. It can also be done in phases.
Sure, it can be spread out over a number of years, but it can be advantageous, especially when time is on the investor's side. So the younger a person is, the more likely they are to do well with it, because the benefit increases over time with the tax deferral or the tax-free growth in the Roth compared to the regular tax deferral of the IRA. So a Roth conversion may be another possibility. And finally, starting January 1st of 2006, corporations are allowed to offer something new called a Roth 401k plan. So we add something new to the alphabet soup, but here's a plan that would work a lot like a regular Roth IRA, no deductions, but tax-free growth, and the limits would be similar to the limits on 401k plans. So I haven't looked up the number, but it's in the range of $14,000 a year.
$14,000 this year and rising.
And that's indexed for inflation. So that may be another opportunity.
And you may want to bring this back to your financial planner and have them clarify the comments and make sure that you both understand the situation. So I want to thank Gareth for writing in and asking us this question.
And we welcome other questions from listeners. You can send them to promoneytalk@gmail.com as an email, or you can send us an audio file. And if we have room on the show, we'll include the audio file questions.
Also, I want to mention you can go to our website at www.promoneytalk.com and sign up for our email list, where we will send notifications of upcoming shows. Next is our interview with Pete Wheeler, and I hope you enjoy it.
I'm talking with Pete Wheeler, author of Stock Options and Grants, The Executive's Guide to Equity Compensation. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
First off, why don't you tell our listeners why you wrote this book?
Jason, we found back in the late 90s that our clients were coming in with some substantial wealth buildup in stock options that they had no idea what they were all about and what they should do with them. And so as we offered to help them on it, at that time we didn't have a whole lot of knowledge either. As we started looking around for a good, concise answers to the various questions we were getting, we found that they didn't exist. So that resulted, as I gathered bits and pieces of information in our writing the first book, which was actually introduced on Pearl Harbor Day 2000. And, of course, we know what was happening to the markets then and thereafter.
Right.
So the stock options weren't particularly popular for a couple of years. But now we're seeing it coming back, and this is now the third rendition of our book, and getting a lot of attention now.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people coming in with stock options issues again. What I really like about the book is that it's written in a question and answer format. So I actually use this book in my practice. I give it to clients who come in with options issues, but I also use it as a reference myself. So let's get into it. Let's start with the basics. Many people may not know that there are different types of options, and that there are different planning strategies for each type of option.
Well, that's right, Jason. There's basically, kind of historically, people thought of two options, either a non-qualified stock option or an incentive stock option.
Right.
There are now a lot of variations on that, which we can touch on in a minute, but let's just deal with those two basics to begin with. The non-qualified stock option means exactly that. It's not qualified under any Internal Revenue Code section and therefore has no particular tax advantages to it. The employer can grant options to anybody, any employee, contractors, board of directors, can extend out to even vendors and give them an incentive to have a future ownership in that company. A non-qualified option can be transferred to family members or given as a gift to charity. An incentive stock option, on the other hand, comes under Internal Revenue Code Section 422 and has a lot of requirements that are associated with it. It can only be given to employees. There are certain tax benefits that come as a result of it, and one significant tax disadvantage that comes with the incentive stock option.
And why would companies issue different types of options? Why would companies issue non-quals, for instance?
Well, the non-qual has the advantage of being able to be issued to anybody.
Okay.
So you can get that down to the rank and file employees, for example. You can incentivize the board of directors, founding shareholders can benefit from it, et cetera. So that would be the significant advantage there. The incentive stock options are generally seen for higher compensated senior executive employees. And because of the tax advantages that come along with it, it is more appealing to the employee.
Can a person have both non-quals or non-qualified options and incentive stock options?
Absolutely, they can. And oftentimes we see with senior management, they have substantial amounts of both and have very little understanding of the difference between the two.
Okay. So it's important that people understand, first of all, what type of option they have. They may have a mix of options.
They will very typically have a mix of options, and they absolutely have to understand this difference and separate those two sets when they're making decisions involving tax considerations, tax strategies, gifting strategies, et cetera.
Good. Now, how does a person determine what type of option they have? Is there an easy way for them to know?
Well, the easy way is they have to read a legal contract, typically.
Okay.
And that's hard for a lot of people, but it's all in the language. The company will have given the employee a grant contract that will specify what type of options they're receiving, under what conditions they can and must exercise, how long they have to exercise. All of that will be contained in typically 5 to 7 pages of fairly heavy legal reading.
Okay. Well, you bring up an important point about that. Options are oftentimes under a vesting schedule. Explain to our listeners what that means.
Okay. Vesting schedule means that there's going to be a period of time after the option is granted before you can exercise that option. And that sometimes will be a period of a couple of years. It could extend over many years, where perhaps they get 20% vesting per year.
Okay.
And then the other part of that is the exercise period. Most options expire within 10 years. And now some of the newer issued options are expiring in 6 or 7 years. That means that if you don't exercise within that period of time, that option is worthless.
So it's really important that people read this legal document and understand the terms.
Jason, it really is. And the other thing that people often miss is if they're terminating employment, what is the requirements upon termination of employment? They may only have 30 days to exercise, or in some cases they may have to exercise before their employment terminates.
So once we've read this document, we understand the terms, we know what type of options we have, we understand the vesting schedule, how long we have to exercise. It's time to do some planning. Let's start off with the non-qualified options. We call them non-quals because, first of all, they're the most popular type of option, or the most common type of option. Well, let's talk about the taxation implications.
Okay. Right, there's a couple of significant events that take place. First of all, and this is from the employee's perspective, there are different issues from the company's perspective, of course, but for the employee, at the time the option is granted, and let's say the company's stock is at that time trading for $10 a share.
Right.
Typically, the option will be granted at the price the company's stock is currently trading at. So your company grants you an option to buy 1,000 shares at $10 a share. There is no tax consequence at that time because that's simply a piece of paper that's giving you a right at some point in the future.
Sure.
Let us make it easy for your listeners and say that those options then vest a year later.
Yep.
So we're now at a point where you can, vesting means you now can exercise those options. But you don't exercise. So again, there's still no tax consequence. Now it's 2, 3, or 4, or 5 years later, and you now have the company stock not at $10 a share, but $50 a share. And you say, boy, that would be great for sending my kids to college. I could use some of that money. Or maybe just I want to go ahead and get that stock because I know it's going to be $100 a share.
Right.
So you exercise that option. At the time you exercise, you are going to pay the $10 a share because that was your guaranteed contract price.
Right.
But the stock is at $50 a share, so that $40 differential is considered ordinary income to you, the employee. The company, under old rules, got to deduct it at that time. Now under new rules, they have to start deducting much earlier, a much different story. But from your perspective, it's income at that time. So that $40, are you going to pay taxes on that?
Now, this is regardless, Peter, of whether I have decided to sell my stock?
That is correct.
Okay. So just by exercising the stock, I owe the taxes between the difference between what it's worth on the fair market and what my options were.
Right. The price that you pay for the stock, which is the $10 a share, versus the fair market value of $50 a share, that differential of $40 is called the spread, and you're going to owe regular payroll taxes on that spread. Now, at that point, you own the stock at $50 a share, which let's say you don't sell it. You didn't need the money to send your kid to college, and you continue to ride the market with that stock, and unlike the 2002-2003 time period that we saw, it's a new day, and it goes to $100 a share over time.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you're, let's say, retiring, and you decide to sell the stock at that point. Now the difference between your $50 share price at the time of exercise and the $100 price at the time of sale is now capital gains.
Okay.
as opposed to ordinary income. So one of the planning strategies, if the stock is really running up, is for employees to try and exercise early on so that they minimize their ordinary income tax consequence and maximize their capital gains benefit.
And what happens in the opposite scenario, Peter, if the price goes down and I've paid my taxes between the difference of 10 to 50, let's say the stock goes down to $30.
That is a question that we had to answer a lot during the early 2000s, Jason.
Right.
What happens is you have recognized $40 as ordinary income and you paid your taxes on it. If the stock dropped to $20 a share, let's say, and you sell it at that point, you have a $30 capital loss per share, and that will be treated either as a long-term loss or a short-term loss, depending upon how long you've held the stock since the time you exercised.
Okay. So that's pretty straightforward then. Let's talk about incentive stock options. Call those ISOs.
Okay. Incentive stock option, again, because of the fact that it is a qualified option, comes under different rules. At the time of exercise, let me step back for just a second. The grant and the vesting are the same as the non-qualified. Nothing changes there. Is at the time of exercise, under that scenario, let's again use our $10 stock that's gone to $50, there is no ordinary income tax consequence to the employee at that time. However, there is an alternative minimum tax potential consequence. And as you've seen in the paper, and I'm sure as your listeners have seen a lot over the last several years, the alternative minimum tax, which originally started out affecting about 2% of all taxpayers, is now affecting somewhere around 37%, I think the number is, projected to continue to go up. And it is a situation where you calculate your ordinary income tax without any AMT items associated with it. Then you calculate your alternative minimum tax, and you pay the higher of the two taxes.
So non-quals are not subjected to the AMT calculation, but ISOs are subjected to the AMT calculation.
Well, that's essentially correct. If you had both in a given year, then just the fact that the non-qualifies have driven your overall income up could result in a greater overall AMT tax.
And AMT is something of a complicated beast, and there are a lot of factors that go into it. But what you're saying is simply by exercising your options on an incentive stock option, the AMT calculation automatically.
You may or may not pay it, but you're certainly subject to it.
Okay.
And that brings up a very important point, Jason, that any of your listeners that have incentive stock options should seek well-qualified advice from experienced tax planners, tax practitioners, financial advisors before exercising ISOs and well in advance of exercising ISOs, because there's a lot of very good but rather sophisticated strategies that can go into this overall planning process that will significantly reduce their tax consequence, but it can only be done before you exercise.
Absolutely, and that's one of the most common mistakes that we see from new clients with options issues, is that they come in, they have already exercised options. Maybe they've exercised options the previous year, and now they're subject to alternative minimum taxation that they were unaware that they would be subject to.
Yeah, and the sad stories that occurred in the early 2000s as the dot-coms and technology stocks went down the tubes is you saw many, many people that ended up exercising their ISOs, say, in 2000 or 2001 as the market was going down, had a tax liability of hundreds of thousands of dollars in many, many cases. And by the time 6 or 8 months later that it came for them to actually have to pay the tax, the stock was worth less than what their tax liability was.
We saw that. Certainly, I think a lot of people read about it in the newspapers. Anyone who lived in an area where technology was hot probably heard those stories firsthand.
Yeah, very, very definitely.
Just so that our listeners can understand it a little bit better, what you're saying is that the spread is subject to the alternative minimum tax.
Yeah, Jason. There is with the alternative minimum tax and the ISOs, there is a non-qualifying event, it's called. And the incentive stock option must be held for at least 2 years from the date of grant and 1 year from the date of exercise in order for it to receive its preferential tax treatment. So if executive exercises his incentive stock options and then finds that the stock price has gone down in value or some other reason dictates that he doesn't want to be subject to the AMT, then if he sells it within the same tax year as he exercised it, he can disqualify that, and it now gets tax treatment the same as if it was a non-qualified stock option instead of an incentive stock option, therefore not subject to the AMT. Used to be that we advise clients to exercise ISOs as late in the year as possible so that they knew what the rest of their tax structure was going to be for that year and kind of make some ISO AMT planning decisions. Since the demise of the dot-coms and tech companies and that whole life experience, shall we say, we have generally recommended that clients exercise their ISOs early in the year so that they can then have a look back to see whether or not they want to disqualify those options before the end of the year.
Right. So, Peter, we've talked about alternative minimum tax, and we've talked about the regular taxation on incentive stock options when a person exercises it. What about capital gains treatment?
Well, the capital gains treatment comes upon the ultimate sale of the stock that was acquired through the stock option.
Okay.
And if it's held less than a year from the date of exercise for a non-qualified option, that would be ordinary income, and would be for an incentive stock option over a year, then it's long-term capital gain.
Okay. So to better illustrate that, let's run through a scenario.
Okay. Let's go back to our $10 stock that's purchased at 50.
Okay.
Let's use the non-qualified for the moment.
Okay.
So we have $40 that's been subject to ordinary income.
Yes.
So he's paid the taxes on that. So he now legitimately, he put in 10. He paid taxes on the other 40. He legitimately has a cost basis of $50. He then turns around and sells that stock for $100. Let's say in the first scenario that he's selling it less than 12 months after exercise. So that becomes a short-term capital gain. And he would pay taxes on the $50 gain. If he holds it over a year, then it's long-term capital gain.
So this, I wish we could illustrate it a little bit better. It's difficult to explain over the phone, but I think that's why it's important that our listeners not only speak to a financial advisor if they have issues, but if they want to learn more and really understand this, I think your book does a really good job of laying it out. As I said before, question and answer format, but also in a very logical, easy to understand way with diagrams and graphs to help illustrate.
It's a complicated topic. I find it, I have to go back to the book regularly and reread a question or two in order to make sure I'm answering things properly. So, and of course, like any other piece over time, it gets out of date and, with tax issues, so you always have to consider that as well. You might want to let your reader know, too, of course, there have been a lot of changes in the last year and a half now, is that the employers are now required to expense. And as a result of that, the use of stock options is certainly decreasing. And one of the alternatives to that is the stock grants, outright stock grants, or stock appreciation rights.
Now, that's really interesting, because up to this point, when people are thinking about executive compensation, they're thinking about stock options. Very few people have thought about stock grants, but like you said, now with the expensing rules, a lot of companies are starting to go to stock grants, and probably the most well-known who's made that shift is Microsoft. Let's talk about grants. First of all, what are grants, and how are they fundamentally different from options?
The difference between a grant and an option is an option is a piece of paper that gives the employee the right to buy the stock at some future date. The grant, typically referred to as restricted stock grants, are an outright gift of the stock, shall we say, from the employer to the employee, but with certain restrictions associated with it. So your employer gives you the stock, but restricts it and says you can't sell the stock for a year or perhaps 2 years or 3 years. It may have a vesting requirement with it that says you can sell a certain piece of it after a year and more after 2 years, et cetera. But you actually own the stock. And so you have the income tax consequence of receiving that stock at that time. We did a study, you mentioned Microsoft, we did a study looking at five-year histories of Microsoft, the first 5 years in a rapidly increasing environment, the late 90s, and the next 5 years looking at 1999 through 2004. And in both cases, the employee actually was better off through a program of stock grants than they were through stock options.
Now that's interesting.
The tax consequences were realized on a year-by-year basis, as opposed to being all at once at a point when the stock had either gone up substantially in value, or in the case of a declining market, obviously the options were of no value, whereas the stock grant, you had the stock still, even though it was worth less, it still had value, and it turned out over that five-year time period that they still had positive value.
So now we may be seeing a shift here, a fundamental shift away from options and towards grants. How are grants taxed?
The grant is taxed to the employee at the time of receipt, at the value of that grant, and then if there are restrictions associated with it, then there can be deferrals associated with that. In other words, you at the point that you actually have ownership of the stock, then you have your tax consequence.
I see. So if it were subject to a similar vesting schedule, in other words, you get a stock grant and invest over 5 years, so you get 1/5 every year, you would pay the taxation on 1/5
right.
each year when you receive it.
Right.
And at that point, is there any difference between that stock and stock that you would have gone out and purchased yourself?
No, there really isn't.
Okay. So I think we've given our listeners a basic understanding, hopefully, of the different types of options. Non-quals, ISOs, and grants, they understand the basics, the very basics of taxation between the three of those. They understand when and why a company would issue, and they certainly understand the importance of knowing what they have and making sure that they seek a qualified professional far ahead of time to do any planning. What happens if I haven't exercised my stock options and I die?
Okay. Most companies provide in their option planning either ISOs or non-qualified that in the event of the death of the employee, the beneficiaries will have 1 year to exercise those options.
Okay.
And so the estate could still exercise those options. It would be it was referred to as income in respect of the decedent. So there's still, if it's non-qualified, there's still be income taxes associated with it. If there's an exercise and sale, there's still be taxes associated with that. But typically, there is a year. The key thing there is for the executor or executrix to very quickly get out the option information and read that document and have a good understanding of when, just how much time they have to exercise.
Okay. Now, a lot of our listeners probably have some estate planning, let's say a living trust. Can options be placed, like other assets, within a trust?
There is no problem at all with the non-qualified options.
Okay.
They can be given to your children. They can be put in an irrevocable trust. You can give them to charity, et cetera. There's no issue there. With the ISOs, they could only go into a trust if it was for the specific benefit of the employee. You can't even give an ISO to a spouse. So if you had the typical estate planning situation where you had husband and wife as joint beneficiaries, that would be, I haven't actually dealt with one of these, but I would think that would be considered a non-qualified event without some very, very specific language that said that's the husband's assets, period.
Another reason to speak to a planner, and certainly your estate planning attorney, is that by placing them in trust, you could effectively recharacterize your incentive stock options to non-qualified stock options.
Exactly.
Certainly a lot of our listeners who work for companies that are startups may have some questions about their stock options, and their stock isn't publicly traded yet.
Right.
So there are some other considerations with those listeners. First off, is there any benefit to exercising a stock option before it becomes publicly traded?
There definitely can be. And this, of course, goes back to the, what we were saying in the late 90s, maybe we'll see it again, is that when a company is going to its IPO, initial public offering, maybe the stock is at $2 or $3 a share. Mm-hmm. And yet the stock initial offering is going to be at $10 a share. And you know that once the company goes public, it may run up to $20 or $30 a share, perhaps not the heady from 10 to 100 that we saw in the late 90s, but still a nice run-up. Under that scenario, you're looking at saying, gee, I've got an option priced at $2, and the company is going to be at 10 and maybe at 20 or 30 within the next 6 months or so. It would sure be nice if I could buy at $2 a share, have no income tax consequences because I'm buying at the price that the stock is currently worth, and then have capital gains instead of ordinary income on all that future appreciation. And that can be done through what's called an 83B election.
Okay.
And under 83B, you're basically saying, I am willing to recognize the income tax consequence of exercising this option now, even though I will not vest for some period down the road, maybe another year, 2 years, or whatever. So well after the IPO and after the stock might run up in value before I have a chance to vest. So there's a significant tax benefit to doing that, in that you're now going to get capital gains on all the appreciation instead of ordinary income. There is one significant disadvantage to that as well. Let's say that you end up terminating your employment, perhaps, or the IPO doesn't happen the way you thought it would happen, and the stock goes down to a dollar a share, it's worthless for you. You have paid your income taxes, and you don't get them back.
And you've also paid your option price, and you don't get that back.
Your option price as well, right? And you don't get that back.
Right. We see people come in who work at startups, and they're one of the early employees, and they may have options in pennies, 1 cent, 2 cents, 3 cents. The fair market value may be, like you said, 1 cent, 2 cents, 3 cents. So there's no tax consequence, no immediate tax consequence from exercising that option. However, there's certainly potential for laying out a large amount of money if there are a substantial amount of stock options.
That's right.
So we were talking about two things there that sort of work hand in hand. One was this idea that you can exercise a vested option before a company goes public, and that there are potentially substantial tax benefits for doing so if the company, of course, eventually goes public and is successful. The other thing that you mentioned was this idea of an 83B election. And an 83B election, as you mentioned, allows somebody to exercise options that have not yet been vested. And that's a pretty powerful tool as well, especially for executives who may have a lot of stock at very low prices. However, in doing so, we're, again, taking on the risk that the company may never go public and you never get that money back.
That's right. The other one that's kind of interesting now coming out of the requirement for expensing is somewhat of a rebirth of something that we always said was really for the small, closely held company, and that's stock appreciation rights. And that's getting quite a bit of interest at the publicly traded company. A stock appreciation right simply says that instead of the employer giving the employee stock, they give them an interest in the appreciation of the stock value from what it is today to what it is at some point in the future. And typically that's been done in smaller, closely held companies. Let's say you and I own our own companies. We have a key employee. We don't want to actually dilute our ownership or have that employee thinking that they have ownership, but we want them to get compensated for their productivity towards the business enterprise. We say, look, our stock is worth $10 a share today. From this point forward, every dollar of increase in the stock price, you'll get 10 cents of it, 10%. So a stock appreciation right is just simply saying that at some point in the future, if we've, and many of them now are incentive-based, you know, if we've met certain goals, then you're going to get a piece of that value in increased compensation. And there's two ways that can be done. It can either be a cash compensation, which has been kind of the historic version of it, not just a cash bonus, but it's tied to the value of the stock. The other that is becoming popular today is what they refer to as stock settled, stock appreciation rights. So whatever the value of that increase is worth to you, I'm going to give you stock in the company for that. Now, that still is taxable compensation at that point.
So this is a great option for our business owners out there who want their employees to have the incentive to tie their performance to the company's performance, if you will, but don't want to give up ownership of the company.
That's the way it's historically been used, and it is a fantastic way of doing that. But as I say, now it's starting to be looked at by the public corporations as an alternative to the non-qualified stock options, which now you have the mandatory expensing on.
So by using this, they don't have to expense the stock.
Not until the stock is actually issued, or if it's a cash settlement, then the cash is given, right? So it's expensed at the same time that it is employee compensation.
The idea of providing employees compensation and not ownership is an interesting concept, and you mentioned briefly in your book about phantom stock as well.
And that's another approach to it, right? Yeah, and again, used more typically with the closely held business.
Can you quickly explain what phantom stock is and what it's used?
Sure. Phantom stock is simply you're essentially issuing a share, if you would, that has no real certification to it, no value to it, other than to say that at some point in the future, that employee is going to receive compensation, perhaps upon sale of the business, termination of employment, if they've been with you enough years, et cetera, they're going to receive compensation as if they had stock, but they never actually owned stock. So it's simply the company providing a guarantee that it's stock-based, if you would.
Pete, thanks for being on the show. You have a special offer for our listeners.
Jason, I would like to make a special offer for the Pro Money Talk listeners. If they are interested in purchasing our book, if they would come to our website, it is available through Amazon as well, but the special offer will only be available on our website at www.wheeler.com, and look under the stock option page. We will put up on our order form there the ability to put in a special code, and that special code we will have is PMT for Pro Money Talk.
Okay.
And by doing so, they will get the book that normally sells at $24.95 plus shipping and handling for $20 even, including shipping, handling, and any state taxes that are associated with it. So,
that's great. Thanks.
Let's make that offer to your listeners.
Well, we really appreciate that. Thanks so much. And thanks for being on the show, Peter.
Jason, good to speak with you, and hope it helps your listeners.
Appreciate it. Have a good day.
Thanks. Bye now.
Well, that's it for this week's show. I think Jason did a great job interviewing Pete Wheeler. Hopefully our listeners got some good information out of how stock options work, and whether you have them or not, it's good to know about how these things work. You know, I'd like to say that we couldn't let this show go by without saying something about the problems in Louisiana and New Orleans this week. We really would like to express our condolences to the people who are going through a really horrible time, and our sadness that because of the looting and the other problems down there, that some of the troops have been diverted from rescue operations. We've made a small donation here, and we'd encourage you to think about making a contribution of some kind to the effort. So our thoughts are definitely with the people whose lives have been swept away. And as I say, on the economic side, we don't know the full impact of it. It's apparent that oil refining capacity has been impacted, that President Bush has allowed some of the money, some of the oil out of the oil reserves, which will help ease the crunch, but it doesn't make gasoline available. It just makes unrefined oil available.
Yeah, we may have time next week, with the benefit of a little bit of hindsight and a little cooling off period, to be able to discuss the potential economic impact of the hurricane. But for now, I think it's more important to acknowledge the human toll.
So thanks for being with us. We do our best every week to bring you financial education and help you make you more successful. And we're just so glad to have you along.
Have a great week.